It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, how does Vice President Pence's stay at a Trump property in Ireland fit into the conversation about emoluments and the operations of a business owned by the president? A law professor digs into the legal and ethical questions. First, you might have heard the word umami in conversations about food and cooking. That's U-M-A-M-I. It's a flavor that's kind of difficult to define. People often describe it as somewhere between savory and meaty. While it's difficult to put umami into words, it is in a lot of foods that are delicious. Things like Parmesan cheese, soy sauce, or mushrooms. And ingredients like these can add a little something special to all kinds of foods. Our next guest recently developed recipes that incorporate umami flavors into everyday cooking, especially vegetarian dishes. Raquel Palzel is a recipe developer and the author of a bunch of cookbooks. Her latest is called Umami Bomb, 75 Vegetarian Recipes That Explode with Flavor. Raquel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you heard my stab at explaining umami. How do you describe the flavor to people?
You know, it's kind of like if you eat something and it tastes fine, and then you add some aged Parmigiano-Reggiano cheese to something, and then it's like, wow, it's kind of, you feel like the sun's shining on you all of a sudden on a cloudy day. That's kind of umami. It's just like everything goes from black and white to technicolor, you know? It makes things just taste bigger and bolder and just like more savory and satisfying.
I think of it as like kind of a richness under other flavors too. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, I mean, it's richness, it's savory, it's kind of this, you know, umami, it's this almost indescribable sense of deliciousness that kind of gets into your cheeks and makes you want to take another bite.
And a lot of times people get this flavor with some kind of meat or fish, and you do a little bit of fish in your book, but your main goal, it seems like, is to get this umami-rich flavor with non-meat ingredients, right?
Yeah, I think it's a great way to give vegetables tons of flavor. And, you know, I eat mostly vegetarian. Well, actually, I eat almost all vegetarian at home. I do eat a little bit of fish here and there. But I really wanted to write a cookbook that reflects how I eat and how my kids eat. And, you know, I have people over for dinner. And so often, like, wow, the vegetables taste so great. How do you do this? How do you do that? And I really wanted to be able to address that because umami, it's simple. It's just adding an extra ingredient, but it really can transform something simple like roasted vegetables or tomato sauce even.
You look at the science of umami at the beginning of your book. It's really just a couple of amino acids that really add this flavor.
Yeah, you know, umami, it's essentially, it's the, when protein breaks down, it becomes amino acids, and that's kind of what makes up umami. Now, there's different amino acids. There's glutamate, there's guanylate. Those are found in mostly vegetables or seaweed and things like that. And then when you pair them together, it becomes even bigger. The flavor becomes even more pronounced and crazy. So throughout the book, you know, sometimes I'll use one umami ingredient and then sometimes I'll pair a few together. So, you know, you get all of these things going on in your mouth. And you know, the proteins, they break down once the umami ingredient is fermented or aged or, you know, seared or caramelized. So take a mushroom. A fresh mushroom might not have a ton of umami in it, but once you grill those mushrooms, it's like, wow, it becomes something totally different.
Talking to Raquel Palzel on this edition of Food Friday. Her new book is called Umami Bomb. You divide the book up by the different ingredients in your toolkit, the different things that can add that umami flavor. We'll get into a couple of specific recipes in a minute, but I'll start with the first one you look at, cheese, a particular kind of cheese. And this is Wisconsin, so why not start with this? Like Parmesan, especially like aged Parmesan and things like that. Talk about how that gives us this umami flavor.
Yeah, well, you know, when cheese is aged, it's losing its moisture content, and you get these little protein crystals that are in the cheese. So if you eat, you know, say aged cheddar, aged Gouda, you know, when you get those little pop, that little pop of crunchiness in a piece of cheese, that's just protein. And so that's why an aged cheese just has more umami than, say, a young mild cheddar or, you know, a lesser aged Parm. So I tried to pick a couple of cheeses that I thought are you know, just beautiful, delicious, easy to find aged cheeses. But that's not to say that other aged cheeses don't have umami. So, you know, any of the cheeses in this chapter, you know, mostly I use Parm, aged Gouda, you know, that really beautiful butterscotchy colored Gouda, and aged cheddar. Because I thought they just added the most, you know, the biggest flavor and the most pronounced umami flavor.
Now, here it is, apple season. And one of the recipes you shared with us, we've got this at WPR.org/Food Friday, Gouda Apple Thyme Galettes. Tell us about this one.
Yeah, I mean, can you think of a better thing to do in the fall than make apple pie? I can't. And I love to take my kids apple picking in the fall. And, you know, when you end up with just more apples than you kind of think you know what to do with. I mean, I went to a school in Wisconsin, actually. I went to Marquette University for a little bit in college. And apples and cheddar, that's kind of a classic combination.
Yeah.
So I started thinking of cheese and apples. And you know, I went straight into pie season. And then I thought, tried to think of something that was a little bit savory but a little bit sweet. And I came up with this idea for kind of a semi-savory galette. And these are like free-form tarts. And why I love them is because they're easy. You know, it's, you don't have to crimp the pie crust. It's essentially just roll the dough and then you free-form it on a sheet pan. And, you know, if a little bit of apple busts out the side, it's okay. And you can call it rustic and no one cares, you know. And so I put a little bit of grated cheese. I put Gouda in the pie crust. And I put Gouda also on top of the thinly sliced apples before I bake it. So there's kind of a double dose of cheese. And it's not to make it cheesy. It just gives it like a little bit of extra, almost a caramel flavor. You know, the cheese kind of mellows out in the oven. And it just brings this kind of extra dimension of flavor to the tart. And there's thyme. And then I also toss the apples with maple syrup. So there's just a lot of flavor going on. And I think it's something really great to make that could be a little unexpected, that you could serve for dessert, you know, with maybe ginger ice cream would be delicious. Or you could serve it as part of a cheese course even, you know, a slice, you know, alongside a cheese board.
We're talking to Raquel Pelzel right now, author of the new book, Umami Bomb, 75 Vegetarian Recipes That Explode with Flavor. She's with us on this week's edition of Food Friday, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about this concept of umami and the flavors and the ingredients that can work into it? Do you have a favorite dish that incorporates these kind of things? Do you add stuff like mushrooms, caramelized onions, soy sauce into your cooking to add that extra something, even if you don't know exactly what that something is? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can find some recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Raquel Pelzel stays with us talking about the unique flavor called umami on this edition of Food Friday and how to add it into our cooking, from soups to entrees to desserts. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest, a recipe that you'd share that kind of has this umami feel to it that we're talking about? Do you like to use ingredients like miso, caramelized onions, roasted up mushrooms to add an extra layer of flavor, or aged cheeses in places you might not expect them? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Raquel, a real common ingredient that people can reach for that you have in your book, soy sauce.
Yeah, soy sauce has tons of umami in it. It's deep, it's bold, and you can kind of add it in when you least expect it. So in my book, I added it. I started playing around with adding soy sauce to different sauces, really. And I found that it worked so well in marinara sauce, which can be kind of a surprise for people. And sometimes they look at me like I'm a little bit crazy. But it does add this really kind of mellow, mild, extra, a little bit of caramel again, but this nice deep note to a marinara. And it doesn't taste like soy sauce. It does not give it, you know, an Asian vibe at all. It still tastes like your favorite soy sauce, your favorite marinara sauce ever, but even more so.
Now, there's a recipe from your soy sauce chapter that you shared with us. We have it up at WPR.org/Food Friday. I apologize to any Italian speakers out there. Eggs in puttanesca purgatory. This the name has a weird story behind it.
It does, kind of. So it's named after a tomato sauce that's essentially called the style of the whore. It's not the most afternoon-y friendly in the recipe content, I guess, but you know, it's because it's kind of salty, it's a little briny, it's a little spicy. It's all of these things in one, and that's from capers, and it's from red pepper flakes, and, you know, it's just like a really delicious kind of bold and funky marinara. And I use it as the base to poach some eggs for a really, really awesome, it could be I eat it for breakfast, but you could totally serve it for dinner with some really nice toast. And, you know, you get a lot of umami from tomatoes. So there's umami in the tomato sauce, and then you get extra umami from the soy that I add to the tomato sauce. So it's really delicious.
It is this week's edition of Food Friday. We're talking to Raquel Palzel. Her new book is called Umami Bomb, 75 Mostly Vegetarian Recipes That Explode With Flavor. We've got a few of the recipes she shared with us at WPR.org/Food Friday. That interesting egg recipe we were just talking about. The Gouda apple thyme galettes we talked about earlier. One more I think we'll get into before we're out of time. And you can call in at 800-642-1234. Now, something that I didn't know fit into this umami category, Raquel, you've got a whole chapter on tomatoes, so prepared maybe in a certain way. Talk about how tomatoes can give us that umami flavor.
Yeah, tomatoes, tomatoes have... they have the glutamate, so when they are cooked or when they're sun-dried or when they're, you know, kind of simmered in a sauce, but again, the proteins break down into the amino acids, and you kind of get this wonderful, bold, rich flavor. So kind of anything with a cooked tomato product can deliver some umami. So, anything from sauce that you put on a pizza creates umami. So then if you add Parmigiano Reggiano cheese to that, you get double umami hit. And then, you know, even roasted tomatoes, which I have a recipe for in the book, you know, you get tons of umami for that, especially when it's tossed with herbs and olive oil and salt. And then you can use those roasted tomatoes to add extra umami to anything from a grilled cheese sandwich to, blending them up to use in a sauce.
Let's bring on a caller now. Karen is with us in Wauwega. Karen, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Karen?
Well, I would like to say that I myself flavor my foods with amino acids, which you can buy in the grocery store, Briggs amino acids, and it gives it that nice, nutty, meaty flavor.
Yeah, I've seen that in stores, liquid amino, I think. Thanks for that, Karen. I've never actually tried that myself, and I heard a yeah there, Raquel. This will fit the bill?
Yeah, you're just cutting straight to the chase. straight to the jugular, straight for the umami. You can totally add a few things to that in anything, and it does add like a bit of bold, a bit of richness for sure.
Thanks a lot for that suggestion, Karen. Oh, getting back to the soy sauce, I meant to ask Raquel. You talk about different kinds of soy sauce. Do you have a favorite for different kinds of cooking that really adds the great umami flavor?
You know, I really like to use, actually low-sodium soy sauce at home, and I usually like to use tamari. Sometimes I get shoyu, sometimes tamari, but I prefer a Japanese soy sauce flavor to be a little bit more mellow, but, you know, a beautiful aged Chinese soy sauce is delicious, too. And then, of course, there's dark black soy sauces, which have even, like, a deeper, richer flavor. So there's a lot of different soy sauces out there to try. You should buy a couple. And sometimes you can find smoked soy sauce, and that is just incredible because you get the umami hit of smoke as well. You know, smoky adds an extra layer of flavor to the soy sauce, and it'll, you know, really create a wonderful savory quality to anything you splash it on.
That reminds me of the third recipe you shared with us. It uses the flavor of smoke and another ingredient, another chapter. You have miso. This is the chili tofu lettuce wraps with smoked salt. Tell us about that one.
I love this recipe so much. So essentially when I was thinking about grilling food, and I was thinking about, you know, you can grill mushrooms, and so often if you're a vegetarian, you'll get maybe a plate of grilled vegetables for dinner while everyone else is having a steak. And you know, that's fine, but, you know, sometimes it's not the most satisfying. In this book, I tried really to kind of think outside the box and to play around with ideas that maybe weren't super expected. So for this one, I took tofu and I made a sauce out of this wonderful sauce made from it's called sambal ulek. It's like an Indonesian paste made from garlic and peppers, and I whisked that with a little bit of miso, and then I used that as a marinade for the tofu, and wrapped that in, after cooking the tofu, I wrapped that in lettuce wraps with peanuts and herbs, and it was almost like, you know, you get a little sweet, you get a little tangy, you get a ton of umami. It's super satisfying, and it's great as like an hors d'oeuvre, because it's handheld, you know, for these last breaths of summer that hopefully you will be fortunate to have, or, you know, or as a meal.
Raquel, thank you so much for joining us and sharing these flavors with us today.
Absolutely. My pleasure. I really hope everyone can play around with some umami ingredients and get some more flavors on their veg.
That's Raquel Palzel. Her new cookbook is Umami Bomb, 75 mostly vegetarian recipes that explode with flavor. You can find three recipes that we've talked about today on the show, the Gouda Apple Thyme Galettes, the chili tofu lettuce wraps with smoked salt that we were just talking about, and the oddly named eggs in Puttanesca Purgatory. Those are all online over at WPR.org/Food Friday. It's time now for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a visit to the arcade.
Like many children of the 80s and 90s, Hilton Jones grew up playing pinball. His favorite machine, the Addams Family, brings about an air of nostalgia to days when kiddie cocktails, a basket of day-old popcorn, and a stack of quarters were all a person needed to get lost in the world of flippers, multiballs, and free games. As adults living in Madison, Hilton and his wife Heidi are tapping into that nostalgia, spreading their love for pinball to others in the Madison community.
I'm Hilton. I'm one of the three co-founders of Madison Pinball.
I'm Heidi. I'm not directly involved with Madison Pinball, but I do support it, and I play a lot of pinball.
And then Heidi also is a founding member of Bells and Chimes. Heidi and I specifically collect rare games that were made in the 80s or early 90s and you don't find as often. We like having those so that when we have friends over, we have games that they've never even played before. I think there's a lot of nostalgia, but I also think everyone's glued to their phones. And arcades are that nostalgia, but also that opportunity to come have a beer and socialize and put away the phone. And pinball specifically, right, it's a physical game. Every game changes, it's unique. And you can cheer each other on. So it's a lot of fun to have that social experience, to do it together. There's a lot of gamers out there. And if you think, you know, a lot of 30-year-olds, people who are at bars drinking, right, grew up in the video game age. I grew up in Belvidere, Illinois in the 90s. And pinball was pretty big in the 90s. And I played a lot of Addams Family Pinball, which is my favorite pinball of all time. Still my favorite pinball of all time. And the collecting side and the rebuilding and the playing side happened postgraduate school.
I grew up in Texas, so not as close to the pinball manufacturing mecca of Chicago, so did not really play a lot of pinball till I met Hilton in graduate school. We played a couple tables here and there, and I realized that it's a good sport, in quotation marks, for people who are super competitive.
Like any sport, it's all about practice. But there are lots of videos, so you can watch online and see flipper techniques, you know, how to trap a ball, how to aim, how to control. Or you can do the most common thing you should do, but no one does, is read the rule card, which is on every single game, on the apron of it, and it will give you the general idea of what you should do on the game.
Or you just try not to drain the ball between the flippers.
Shoot the blinky light. A lot of people, they really get into pinball when they start to realize that it's kind of like a board game. There's objectives, there's a rule set, there's a strategy of what you're shooting for. Instead of just trying to keep the ball in play, you're actually aiming for a shot.
What I feel most proud about as far as playing was there's a big tournament in Pittsburgh every year that has like 840-something people called Pinburg. And this past year, I qualified in the A division and qualified in place 62 out of 843 people, and that's against the top pinball people in the world.
I'm continually amazed. You know, I lived through the 90s when it was really popular. In the 90s, in Belvidere, Illinois, a little podunk town, every spot had a pinball machine, the Hub Cigar Store and every restaurant, and that died out. And it's really neat to see it come back. I don't know where it stops or if it does stop. I mean, I'm sure it's cyclical, but everything seems to be going up from here.
And the other side of that, too, is not only are people becoming more interested in it, there's also more manufacturers coming into the picture. One of them actually is local to Wisconsin. Spooky Pinball is based in Benton, Wisconsin, and they've come out with a couple games. And I think just the wide variety of people and companies manufacturing pins is also helping grow the popularity of pinball.
I think we've taken ownership of it. I mean, I'm proud to say I'm a pinhead.
Why, thank you, Bing.
That story came to us from WPR's Jenny Peek. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
The vice president was in Ireland this week on personal and professional business. Vice President Pence drew some suspicion when people found out he was staying at the Trump International Golf Course and Hotel, more than 100 miles from where he had meetings scheduled with Irish leaders in Dublin. Here's what the vice president had to say about it.
I understand political attacks by Democrats, but if you have a chance to get to Doonbeg, you'll find it's a fairly small place. The opportunity to stay at Trump National in Doonbeg to accommodate the unique footprint that comes with our security detail and other personnel made it logical. We checked it with the State Department. They approved us staying there. And
Pence's stay is one of several recent stories bringing the topic of emoluments back into the news. Juliet Sorensen is executive director of Injustice Watch and clinical professor of law at the Northwestern Pritzker School of Law. Juliet, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, there's been some back and forth between the vice president's staff and the White House over whether or not the president had personally suggested that the vice president stay at his property in Ireland. But either way, how does this all fit in? People spending money that ultimately profits the president. How does this fit into the Constitution?
The Constitution and the framers felt very strongly on the question of corrupt or improper benefits flowing to federal officers. And so there are two separate emoluments clauses in the Constitution. One of them relates to foreign governments and lays out the rule that a foreign government can't essentially pass cash to the president or a federal officer in any form. The other clause is the domestic emoluments clause, and that provides that the president may receive a salary during the president's time in office, but that the president can't receive in that period any other emolument from the United States in any form.
And that would include potentially, now the vice president in this Ireland case, for the personal part of his stay, he said he paid for that himself, but Secret Service detail or things like that, that's the U.S. government, as I understand it, paying money to this estate owned by the president. Is that right?
That's right. And that's your tax dollars.
And what happens, though, when it comes to enforcement of these emoluments clauses in the Constitution? It would be easier if it were anybody but the president to enforce something like this, right?
Well, you know, the emoluments clause has been, frankly, rarely discussed and even more rarely litigated. Earlier today, Congressman Elijah Cummings sent a request for documents over to the White House because the Oversight Committee of the House is investigating a possible violation of the emoluments clause. It may turn into congressional hearings, but the question of enforcement is in part an open question because it's almost never happened before.
There have been legal challenges from different parties so far, and at least some of them have been turned away because courts ruled that the people bringing the charges didn't have standing. So it didn't really get to the merits of the case. Is it a tricky case to figure out who makes a case against the president under the emoluments clauses?
Well, it is. You know, the House of Representatives is exercising its oversight function. That's obviously different from a civil suit. And it was a civil suit that was dismissed earlier this year. A court found that the plaintiff suing didn't essentially have personal exposure or personal damage by any possible violation of the Emoluments Clause. So you're right, the court didn't reach the merits of the case.
Talking to Juliet Sorensen from Northwestern University, looking at the president, his ownership of the Trump Organization, and questions about who pays money to properties owned by that organization and whether it can profit the president. This came up again recently when the president was at the G7 summit and suggested the next summit could be held in the future at the Trump National Doral Miami Golf Resort. Is that worth scrutiny?
It absolutely is. And as I understand it, that's also on Congress's radar. That, of course, raises the question of the Foreign Emoluments Clause, because it would be foreign governments coming to the United States, staying at one of the properties owned by the president, and in turn translating into money or a benefit flowing to the president from a foreign government.
When we've seen presidents in the past have business interests of one sort or another, often they've been wealthy people. How have these things been handled? How have they avoided having questions raised?
So for the period of government service, the president and the president's business interests are completely and totally separated and walled off. If there were any type of business operation, the president would not personally stand to benefit. And in an abundance of caution, steps would be taken to ensure that the president wouldn't stand to benefit in the future, that is to say, from any business transaction while the president's in office, but after he or she steps down.
And President Trump has said, okay, I still own my share of the Trump Organization, but I'm not running it. I've handed that off mainly to his sons in this case. Is that enough to have enough arm's length there?
To my mind, it's a big so what, particularly when the president is suggesting that foreign leaders stay at his properties and apparently suggesting or encouraging his vice president to stay at his property in Ireland.
What are you watching for now in Congress as you say, committees start to look at this issue and figure out what, if anything, they can do about it?
You know, I think that there is going to be a legal debate about the scope of the Emoluments Clause. It is being held to some extent in a vacuum. I think there's going to be a debate about the state of mind, about the intentions of the president and the vice president in making these arrangements.
Looks like we lost our guest, Juliet Sorensen, Executive Director of Injustice Watch and Clinical Professor of Law at the Northwestern Pritzker School of Law. We're talking about the president and his business ownership of the Trump Organization, and then the use of properties owned by that organization, money paid into it by American government officials, by the taxpayer in some cases, and by representatives of foreign governments. You can weigh in with your thoughts on that issue. You can email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. And looks like we have Juliet Sorensen back. Juliet, we lost you there. Could you pick up where you left off?
Yes, I'm sorry about that. So just to conclude, there's going to be some debate about the party's state of mind. Was President Trump actually anticipating a financial benefit when he encouraged the vice president to stay at the resort, for example? The state of mind was also at play when House Republicans complained about Barack Obama receiving an emolument from the government of Norway when he accepted the Nobel Peace Prize. That complaint was eventually abandoned by all, since nobody expected that that President Obama intended to be corrupted or that the government of Norway was trying to improperly influence him.
From an ethical standpoint, regardless of where the law ends up falling, is the general practice to try to keep a more clear line, not to ease into the gray area by presidents or other federal officials?
Absolutely. And let me be clear. This is very straightforward from an ethical perspective. Ireland is not a country where there is a shortage of well-equipped hotels. The notion that Vice President Pence, according to his statement, needed to stay at a Trump hotel, needed to put his security detail there, it's frankly preposterous. So why not avoid the entire debate and, if not an actual violation of the Emoluments Clause, at least the appearance of self-dealing by staying somewhere else?
Would it be worth it for future presidents, for Congress to tackle this issue and lay out stricter guidelines than what is currently in the Constitution itself?
Yes, that could take place in a variety of forms. Probably federal legislation would be the most clear-cut way to build on the Constitution, which, as in many areas of the law, provides a foundation that is then elaborated on by the U.S. Code.
We'll leave it there for now. Juliet, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Juliet Sorensen, Executive Director of Injustice Watch and Clinical Professor of Law at the Northwestern Pritzker School of Law. She joins today for a look at the legal and ethical concerns surrounding the use of Trump properties by government officials, foreign and domestic. Here's some music you may not be used to hearing the UW-Madison Marching Band play. That was the band rehearsing some Beyoncé this week under its new director, Corey Pompey. The previous director, Mike LaCrone, held the position for 50 years. The band is practicing, I think, right now, but Corey Pompey joined us in the studio earlier today. Thanks a lot for coming up to the studio today.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, what appeal did this job, this big Wisconsin gig, have for you? What drew you to this one?
Well, the tradition of the band program here is one of the things that drew me to this job, as well as the wonderful institution that we have at this university, highly rated academically. And so those two things combined made it really attractive to me.
And people like to get to know their band director here in Wisconsin, I think. Tell us a little bit about yourself. What should people know about you?
Well, I must admit, I'm not the most interesting person in the world.
Same.
I'm from Birmingham, Alabama. I taught for a few years in the public schools, and I had the great fortune of attending the University of Texas to get my doctorate. And then I started work at Penn State for a while. I worked at the University of Nevada, Reno, and now I'm here. And I absolutely love what I do.
Now, of course, you're taking the job after Mike LaCrone left after, a year or two. What kind of contact have you had with him?
Well, we see each other quite a bit, actually. A few months ago, I guess that's an overstatement, July.
Seems like a long time ago.
We had an opportunity to have breakfast, and all of the current him and the other band directors here, we sat down and we chatted for a bit and had wonderful conversation. And other than that, it's you know, we see each other in the hallway. And when we're in the hallway, we stop and chat for a little bit and then we go on our way.
Now, on the one hand, people have talked about, maybe this is kind of intimidating taking over for this person who's been in the job for so long. But in a way, it seems like a great opportunity to decide, okay, where do we stick with tradition? Where do we start to introduce new elements? How do you balance those two things?
Well, it's not the easiest thing, I must admit. And I can't say I have a 3-point plan, if you will, for how that goes. I kind of just try to take the temperature of the room, or in this case, the temperature of the field, and rely on my colleagues to say, you know, what happens if we do it this way? And if I get the sense that maybe that's something we wouldn't want to do, then perhaps we wouldn't go in that direction. But I am of the opinion if it's good, there's no need to change it. So that's kind of how we approach things. And these changes that I'm talking about I don't honestly know if the average person would be able to notice these types of things. This is more, for lack of a better term, inside baseball uh-huh. type stuff that might not be apparent to someone that's looking at the band or listening to the band from the 50-yard line.
One thing people will see, or I guess hear, actually as a change, you're going to freshen up the songbook a little bit. Talk about some of the music you're going to draw
into the picture. A little bit. This Saturday, or tomorrow, we'll have a shortened halftime show. So in 3.5 minutes, you'll hear music from Beyonce, The Killers, The Jonas Brothers, and Adele.
Wow, that's quite a mix. And I'm trying to picture in my head how I would adapt, or how someone who knew what they were doing would adapt those for marching band format.
Well, that's an interesting question. Well, what we did is so tomorrow's High School Band Day. Mm-hmm. And we really wanted to try to perform music that would perhaps cater to them a little bit. So we really racked our heads to find 4 tunes that might work in a medley. And so then after that, it's a matter of sitting in the room and listening to all of those tunes and finding out which sections may go together the best and just go from there. And it's not just those 4 tunes we listen to, probably dozens of tunes, and those just happened to be the 4 that made it in.
Talking to Corey Pompey, now director of the UW-Madison Marching Band. Big debut tomorrow at a home game. People see the finished product on the field, the actual marching, the actual song. Can you talk about the work that goes into this for the student musicians and marchers? What kind of workload do they have to prepare for these shows?
It's a tremendous amount of work. In fact, I have great admiration for the students that are in the band because they are extremely dedicated. We started our rehearsals on August 19th. And we've been doing it almost every day since August 19th. Most days we've been having what we call two-a-days, where we'll have a session in the morning and we'll have a session in the afternoon. We've had some three-a-days, where we have a morning session, an afternoon session, and a night session, all in the service of making sure that we are prepared and ready to go. Now, this is before school has even started. Now that school has started, we rehearse Tuesday through Friday from 3:30 to 5:30. And on game days, we rehearse several hours before the game. So it's quite a bit of commitment. In fact, their Saturdays are consumed by the band.
Did I see somewhere you hope people in the public come and watch some of the rehearsals?
People are welcome to come and watch rehearsals at any time.
And that's what will we see there that we wouldn't see? We'll get some of that insider baseball, right, if we go and watch that.
Well, if you were to come to rehearsal, you may see me raising my voice a little bit, hopefully in love. but you'll see us marching up and down the field, a lot of starts and stops, going back to correct things. You may hear us perfecting music. So it's a lot of refining that's taking place. And in the beginning stages of a show, you'll see us learning and trying to put the puzzle pieces together.
Now, I'm a little biased when it comes to stacking up university fight songs against each other. On Wisconsin's a pretty good tune. Is that one you're going to be happy working with day in and day out?
It's a delight. I find myself whistling it all the time. It never fully leaves me.
Now, as a band director, I imagine you play all the instruments or many of them. Is there an instrument of choice, the first one you've gone to as a musician yourself?
Well, I suppose it would be a little bit of an overstatement to say that I play them all. I can dabble with them all, and I certainly wouldn't want the listening public to hear me playing any of those instruments. But my primary instrument is the saxophone.
Me too. That's
awesome.
Really?
Yeah. Fantastic.
It's been a long time since I marched with one, since high school.
Well, you and I are both in the same boat.
People have talked about whenever anybody moves to Wisconsin, especially you've been in the South for a good chunk of your life, they talk about the weather. I think we overhype it. We over scare people. You've been in Pennsylvania. Does the weather here worry you coming into the winter?
It does not worry me. I can't say that I'm looking forward to it, but when it gets here, I will manage. Whatever that means, I'll do it.
I always found going back to high school and marching in the Christmas parade or whatever, it's really hard to keep people in tune when it's, you know, 20 degrees outside. How does a band manage playing in the cold?
It's really, really difficult. Almost impossible, to be honest with you. So you do the best you can. Once it gets to be a certain temperature, it's tough because those instruments are not designed to be able to play in that kind of weather. So you have to work with the tuning slides. You have to make sure that everything's working the way it needs to be. In some cases, our students will get acrylic or plastic mouthpieces. Typically, we play those instruments with metal mouthpieces. But once it gets too cold, you get worried about the mouthpiece sticking to the face. So the best answer for you that I can give is that we do the best we can. But it's quite difficult.
Now, as we wrap up, if I were in your position the night before the first home game, I don't think I'd be able to sleep tonight. I'd be really nervous. How are you feeling going into this? What's in many ways your debut here?
Well, I dare not say that I feel settled. I feel anything but settled. I wouldn't say that I'm nervous. Maybe I'll be nervous once it's time to do Badger Bash and once we march in that stadium, but believe it or not, there's still a considerable amount of work that needs to be done between now and tomorrow. Not necessarily from the students, but from the staff. We've got press books that we have to finish, the I's that need to be dotted, T's that need to be crossed. So I'm really focused on making sure that we complete all the tasks that need to be completed before we take the field.
Well, then I'll let you get back to work. Have a great show, a great performance tomorrow, and a great career here at UW.
I appreciate that very much. Thank you again. We really appreciate all of the support from your listeners, and thank you for having me.
That's Corey Pompey, Director of Athletic Bands and Associate Director of Bands for UW-Madison's School of Music. The UW-Madison Marching Band will perform Saturday for the first time under his leadership at the football team's home season opener. Have you ever been in a marching band? Are you now? Love to hear about your experiences. Rain or shine, summer or winter in a marching band. Email us ideas@WPR.org or tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. Let us know where you played, what you played, and if you have fond memories or, you know, just memories. There's some new research that could help put an end to the mystery of the Loch Ness Monster. It won't put an end to it, but it's still interesting. Scientists from New Zealand journeyed to Loch Ness in Scotland to hunt for Nessie, but they weren't looking for a visual sighting. They were hunting for DNA. They collected 250 water samples from Loch Ness, and they took an up-close look at the DNA they found there, did a survey to see what they could see. One theory that's been out there is that Nessie is a plesiosaur, a long extinct swimming reptile. Survey says no plesiosaur DNA. Also no shark or catfish or sturgeon DNA. Those are some of the other theories that have been out there. What did they find? Lots and lots of DNA from eels, which can get pretty big. So have mistaken eel sightings led to legends of the Loch Ness Monster? Now, there have been, in the reporting on this, there is confirmation. People have spotted eels in Loch Ness. I'm guessing the people who are true believers are not going to be convinced that it was just eels all along for the last 1,000 years. One fun fact, the eels in question migrate from the Caribbean islands to the Scottish lakes, many miles away. This is Central Time.